It is Destazapod in a post-eclipse world. Has the fabric of our reality changed? Has it been altered? Who's to say? I don't know. But in any case, I got questions to answer, and I got questions from last week that I thought I had answered, but had not actually been recorded and uploaded to the episode. So I'm going to try to make amends and cover what I believe I missed. So apologies for that. Let's get right into it with a great question that I know I spent a lot of time on last episode, even though it didn't record. This is a question from Grant Sanders. In the periods where you were single, did you ever have any potential matches lose interest once you shared your toy-related occupation / interests? I've been wondering if there's a sexy, attractive, comprehensive way to briefly explain my medium, or if I'm just rizzless. Now, I have had the benefit of meeting not only Grant Sanders, but his wonderful family. There is no lack of riz in the Sanders clan, let me tell you. They're extremely affable, charismatic, energetic, entertaining, lovely people, each and every one of them. I'm hoping I get to see them and spend some time with them at this year's Toy Pizza Expo. So one, let's do away with the idea of Grant being rizzless. He's not rizzless. He is the new baby Gronk when it comes to riz, if you follow. But more to the point and the spirit of the question, no, I've never sort of acted other than how I am, especially regarding my hobbies or my careers or things like that. You know, I think that dating is a numbers game, so you have to go on a lot of dates, maybe hundreds of dates, to find somebody that's worthy of spending time with. And also, dating is a confidence game. Not to say you are a con man, but that is to say probably the single most important element to dating is confidence. And that could be a false confidence, that could be true self-confidence, could be any shade of that. But the one thing that is unattractive to anybody in a dating scenario, man, woman, non-binary, whatever your shade or gradient is, it is a lack of confidence, for sure. It's somebody that just is insecure, doesn't believe in themselves, whatever the case may be. That is the number one most erroneous thing you can bring to a dating scenario. Look, I know plenty of guys that are under 6 feet tall who have done really well for themselves. I know a guy who's 5 feet tall, nothing, has a wonderful wife, wonderful life. Did not hold him back. I know plenty of ugly guys that have gotten really attractive women. I know every variety of relationship that's out there under the sun. There are people out there that will date anybody, really. But having sort of no confidence is probably a deal breaker for the vast majority of people that are out there. So when it comes to, you know, the very far off history when I was single, I don't know. I never felt embarrassed by collecting toys or being in the toy industry. I never felt like I had to hide it or make apologies for it or like pretend to be something I wasn't. I think that because I've always felt like I'm working in the industry I want to work in and I'm pursuing the creative projects I want to pursue, that anybody's outside opinion to that really doesn't matter much. You know, there's not going to be a hot girl that's like, eh, I don't like toys, that's going to make me give up toys or pursuing, you know, things in that realm. It just has never occurred to me, and, you know, I don't know. I just don't think it's a factor. I think you don't look for a way to spin this, a sexy, attractive sort of terminology you can use as a euphemism to, like, slide this hobby or this pursuit under the radar to somebody. I say go the opposite way. Just be frank and upfront. And if you're in Grant's situation, you have nothing to be embarrassed about because this man has put the hours into his craft. He's been working for many years to be a sculptor, to have resin releases, to build a customer base. He's very well known in the Night of the Slice world and also, you know, the indie toy realm. I see all of that as a badge of courage. I don't see anybody, you know, I see no reason to sort of pettifog or or try to diminish what it is your calling in life is. Now, there's another factor at play here that I think is important, and it does give a little bit of perspective. When I was in my, you know, let's say like 19, 20, that sort of era of my life, these pursuits, toys, comics, Marvel films, action figures, they were not viewed in the same way that they are viewed today in society. Later in life, I had quite a few girlfriends that were collectors of toys or, you know, into comic books or did cosplay. Like, the hobby really within the span of 20, 30 years changed completely to be much more favorable, much more interesting to members of the opposite sex. While when I first got started, you know, doing everything I was doing, it was still kind of a male-dominated hobby and industry. That is very much changed by today's standards, 2024. So while me trying to go on a date in, say, 1999, before The Matrix came out, I might downplay that I have a vintage Kenner TIE Fighter in my bedroom, sure. But today, God forbid if I'm ever single again, I would not even burn a single calorie thinking that I had to hide or obfuscate, if I'm saying that correctly, this pursuit and this hobby. The thing that is attractive to other people is, and I'm speaking just from a sort of, forgive me, a sort of white cis male viewpoint here. The thing that is attractive to the opposite sex is somebody who is meaningfully doing something with their lives, right? They found a calling, they found a pursuit, and they are gaining a sort of mastery with those skills. That could be anything, you know? That could be a guy who's a computer programmer, who's built a cool app, who, whatever, has gone to school for it. Doesn't fucking matter. The thing that people on a date can sniff out is if you are listless, if you are aimless, if you don't like anything, if you're just a miserable fucking person, you know, that, if you spend all day long on the internet, like, those sort of things are red flags that absolutely drive people away from wanting to sort of have another date or have a connection and an experience with you. Really loving something very passionately and participating in a community and having an expo to go to where you're going to show off your wares and be around friends, that's fucking cool, right? May not be a cool, you know, genre of hobby, but who gives a fuck? That's a cool thing to, like, be plugged into a community, to be, like, bettering your artwork, to have an audience that embraces it. That's the sort of stuff any partner would want to see in somebody they're dating. Now, I will also say, I will give a little bit of credit here, because there are certain regions of this country that are maybe more traditional, possibly more conservative than other parts of this country. I've grown up living on the East Coast, having access to the beach, living in relatively populated metropolitan areas or close thereof. And, you know, my experience is going to be different from people that, you know, might live elsewhere or have a much more insular, closed off sort of community. But comic conventions and stuff like that, those are pretty prevalent in everywhere in the country. And you can go and be around people that have the same interests as you and that are not going to sort of be puzzled or be turned off by what you're doing. And if they are, then that's a gift, because you know right away this is not going to be a person that you want to be with. I'll share a brief story. There was a girl I dated for maybe a little under a year, maybe a little over a year. And she was not of any of this ilk whatsoever. She had zero interest in anything related to comic books, toys, movies, whatever the case may be. And she worked in the fashion industry. She was from that sort of background. And she didn't understand this pursuit of mine at all. And actually, a couple occasions, she found it quite foolish that I would spend money to work on a comic book that I would put out and only a few people would read. Now, this was a person that had no capacity for any creative pursuits of their own, right? They only saw what I was doing, and it seemed like such a folly to them. Needless to say, this person is not in my life and did not hang around for very long. But there is, you know, there's certainly a sort of subconscious envy, I would say, to people that might be perplexed or puzzled by doing the things that somebody like Grant would do. And I can tell you, you just don't want to waste your time with those people anyway. For me personally, I think that the right sort of combination is probably about 20-80. So you want somebody who's at least like 20% interested in the same stuff to 80% interested in their own stuff that you're going to learn about and be exposed to and are going to change and transform you. Now, that might seem like a lot of contrast and very little in common, but for me personally, that's the combination that's worked best for me. I want somebody that's like open to watching a movie like Tremors, right? And maybe we have some cultural touchstones between, I don't know, like Queens of the Stone Age or some band like that. But I don't want to date somebody who's the same as me, who only has the same pursuits as me, because that can be pretty fucking boring as well. So, you know, it is a bit of a bell curve, and you want to kind of end up somewhere in the middle. But again, like, thinking too much about all this stuff, it's sort of, you know, this is all an abstraction. Just go on dates. Go on a lot of dates. That's how you kind of suss these things out for yourself. And as far as I'm concerned, I see no reason to kind of pursue any matches that lose interest or not be upfront about what it is you're doing. Because in Grant's case, I think he's doing a great job, and I think there's a lot to be proud of there. Now, I'm hopping over to the Top Secret Discord, which you can access by being a member of patreon.com/JesseDestasio. It's quite a lovely community, I will say. I may have answered this last week. I cannot remember. So let's just do it again from Skywalking. Do you think we can get more Device Ninja in Material Styles? For those newer listeners, a Material Style is just largely an unpainted figure. Usually it's a version of an already released figure. And that is really made for customizers and builders to kind of have extra parts at a cheaper price and go crazy with building and creating new characters and things like that. So the Device Ninjas have not sold very well. It is not surprising because it is a very old sculpt at this point. I did break it out, dust off, get rid of the mothballs, and run our trio of Golden Ninjas very recently. And they have sold okay. I kind of made my money back, but there's a lot of inventory. So if people love Device Ninjas and they want to see more Device Ninjas, I kind of got to sell out of the ones I already have in stock. And, you know, this is unsurprising at this point. We are 9 years into selling Knights of the Slice figures. And just a lot of people have what they need of certain sculpts. And so that kind of, you know, it kind of comes down to like a mathematical equation. Can I spend money on a figure that I know is going to take a little bit longer to sell, or should I sort of try to follow trends or what's selling or things like that? I don't always know the answer to that, but in the case of Device Ninjas, I think pretty conclusively I have quite a bit of sales data that would shy me away from doing anything with that figure in the near future, at least until a little bit more of this inventory has sort of made its way out there. Next up from Cappy, we got a good question here. Where does the current line of TMNT/MOTU crossover figures sit in the homage, reinvention, retread discussion? Related question, how do you imagine the fan base would react to those figures if they were presented with zero branding? Let's remove the turtles, they're too obvious, because those are some damn cool designs in that line. You know, I think a couple things here. So one, I've touched on before, Masters of the Universe, I never had a ton of them as a kid, and I do like them generally, but I don't love them, and I'm not crazy about Masters of the Universe. I'm not a huge MOTU collector. I pick up the odd figure when I see it. I have the Origin Snake Armor He-Man, which, you know, for whatever reason was kind of an appealing figure to me back in the day. I remember being in Hong Kong and buying the jumbo vinyl of the Snake Armor He-Man that really didn't get much of a release in the States, but I was over there working for Jazzwares, so it was a nice time in my life, and I kind of have pleasant memories about that one specific He-Man. But, I guess, like, I'm not the right person for the line. It's not targeted at me. I'm, at best, a very casual He-Man consumer, and so, like, I don't think the magic really works on me. I think I'm immune to it in some ways. I'm happy for anybody who is inspired or really their brain lights up with this line. I think that's great. I'm happy for people to find joy in it and collect it and do what they want. I'm just not like the... I'm not a good brand ambassador for it, if that makes sense. From the outside, there seems to be some really, really cool designs. And then there seems to be, like, some perplexing, befuddling, unclear mashups and designs. Now, somebody pointed to the comics that are included with the figures actually explain some of the weirder choices. Like, there's a clear purple He-Man. That doesn't really make much sense in terms of, like, what does that have to do with Ninja Turtles, etc. I've been told it is sort of legitimized and explained within the narratives of the comics, but I think that they probably needed to do a better job of, like, explaining what it is that they're selling, right? I think that's kind of always the job of marketing. What is this thing that we want you to spend money on? It feels a bit muddled and confused in terms of, like, the story that they're telling visually with the characters and the mashups. The other thing is, I've not seen any of these figures at retail. Now, I don't go to retail stores all that often. Maybe once a month I go to Target or Walmart. But I've seen hide nor hair of any of this. So I don't really, like, have an in-person opinion. I think, like, if I saw the Casey Jones Men-at-Arms crossover figure, that looks kind of cool. If I saw that in store, I would probably pick it up. But I have no interest in, like, chasing these things down online. You know, if I came by in a convention, I think I would, you know, make a day of it and probably have fun with that figure. But because for whatever reason, regionally, these things do not seem to be showing up, it also leaves me kind of, like, you know, feeling completely neutral about it. You know, I assume there are people out there having a good time with this line. I've not been exposed to it. I've not seen it at retail. So, you know, I'm just kind of here like, yeah, it's fine. I'm happy for it to be out there. I do think, like, you know, it's probably, if we step back from a licensor standpoint, it's probably a smart move, right? Like, He-Man is an older IP. Ninja Turtles has a lot of heat on it right now, especially coming off of last year's animated film that set the world on fire. He-Man has really been everywhere in the past couple of years, but I don't feel like it really gained much traction. I know there were two different Netflix series. I believe one of them is still continuing on. I hear a little chatter about it here and there, but I've never had anybody, like, demand that I sit down and watch this stuff. So I think, like, if I'm Mattel, yeah, I want some of the heat going on with Ninja Turtles to kind of reinvigorate Masters of the Universe. So in that perspective, it's probably, you know, a good crossover in terms of, like, brand building and you know, injecting a little bit of life into it. Me personally, I just want new ideas. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I get sort of animated about or thinking about. I just saw, speaking of Grant Sanders, he gave me a little teaser peek at his newest figure, and I love it. I think it's great. I think it's going to be very well received. And sure, it pays a glance and a nod to things that have come before, but to me, it's a Grant creation. It's him synthesizing ideas from toy lines and genres of the 80s and 90s, and, you know, that stuff is always going to occupy more space in my mind than seeing, you know, a Ram Man Ninja Turtles crossover. Now, to the second part of this question, how do I imagine the fan base would react if those figures were presented with zero branding? I'm going to assume you mean no He-Man branding, no Ninja Turtle branding, just as a sort of generic barbarian, question mark? Is that what you're getting at? I mean, I think they're aesthetically pretty interesting figures. Have they fixed how these He-Man figures hold accessories? Because they really suck at that. I hope that they just kind of get a little more inward bend towards the thumbs and they'll be, you know, off to the races. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I think that these are reasonably well-designed figures. They're at a great price point. They all seem to work really well. I haven't had any breakage issues with any Mattel He-Man stuff. Like, it's all reasonable. It's all good. But, you know, will anything really be great in this sort of system of just rehashing and using old IP? That's kind of the more interesting question. How does something like really be transformative and like exceptional if we're just taking two IPs and mixing them together? What is the sort of formula that makes something like that really stand out? Not just sell toys, but kind of like have a bigger impact. And I don't think I know the answer to that. Next up on the Discord, a question from the Robot Assassin. With Hasbro firing its Dungeons & Dragons bookmaking division and ushering in artificial intelligence for Dungeons & Dragons campaign, do you think there will be an anti-AI movement towards people appreciating human-made work as corporations adopt more and more soulless AI to generate their own media content? So first, as a disclaimer, I don't know the veracity of these claims. I haven't seen or read anything on it, but I'm not that big into sort of the inner workings of AD&D and Wizards from the Coast and things like that. So I don't know, and I can't comment if they did lay off everybody, every human being in the bookmaking division, and they're solely using AI. That seems a little unlikely to me, but I don't know. I'm going to take the question as it's stated and assume it is true. I think, like all the other companies that are starting to backtrack, if Hasbro goes to a solely AI-generated methodology for producing their content, they're going to quickly realize their mistake and have to rehire people. There was a gaming company that was working on the very first AI-only AAA title video game. And guess what happened within a few months of their announcement? They said the project's dead and it does not work without human input. What I would recommend for people who are interested in this sort of thing is, again, to go listen to Brad Tramiel's AI report, because I think he very succinctly sums up this moment we're in, and it's a incredibly worthy watch. And for $5, you get not just that report, but like 24 other reports, and he's a brilliant mind. It's really quite fascinating to watch everything he's done. But basically, and I'll surmise what Brad's ultimate treaty on this is, and I believe he's correct. Art is created by humans based on humans' personal experience. So a Magic the Gathering card artist puts together a drawing of a dragon based on what they like about dragons, the artists that influenced them, the time they saw a dragon when they were scaling the Andalusian cliffs in Spain, whatever the case may be. Every piece of artwork handled by a human is infused with that life experience, with that perspective, right? We make artwork that represents our the problems we see in the world and our wishes for the future. Within every sort of stroke of the pen, we have baked in our DNA and our sum total life experience. That's what gives us perspective. That's what makes art interesting, unique, and engaging. AI cannot create art from the human experience. They can mimic things, and they can mimic things pretty convincingly, but they will never have a connectability to the human experience, because large language models, which is what AI is, I think calling it AI is being a bit, putting it too much on a pedestal. This is simply clouds of thought that are connecting certain keywords to certain keywords, and usually linking that to an image from a Google search or whatever the case may be. They are not creating work that is reflective of an AI's experience, right? If they did, it wouldn't make any sense to us. It would just be self-referential to the path that an AI has taken, the experiences they've had, the memories they have, the whatever the case may be. So what we have is not AI creating human art, it is AI mimicking human art. And again, mimicry can fool you for a couple seconds, or it can be pretty convincing for a little while, but it will never connect and transform you. So there is certainly reason to fear for, you know, people's short-term prospects as a freelance artist within the AI world, but we're viewing this and missing the entire point of how art is sort of created, what is required to do that. We have this belief that this technology is already ready to supplant everybody flawlessly and seamlessly. If you've seen any of these really ridiculous full motion video AI clips, again, they work for a second or two, but as you start to pay attention to anything happening in the background or the number of fingers, the facade crumbles. And there have been billions and billions of dollars put aside working on this issue and this technology, and we are now about 2 years into it, and it has not gotten any better. There seems to be a very finite ceiling to the visual artwork that is generated by these large language models. Maybe that changes, I don't know, but for right now, there's tons of resources and money and VC firms focused on this idea intensely. And we're about, you know, 24 months out from this big boom, and it still looks like shit. But here's to the sort of core of the question that Thomas has put out here. Will there be a backlash from consumers against AI-generated artwork? And I would say only if it affects pricing. If people are going to be able to get things cheaper, they're probably going to be okay with having some level of AI-generated content, assuming they're fooled long enough or it's not apparent to them. Unfortunately, I think people are going to stick to the material reality of how much something costs. And, you know, I think that largely if there's a benefit or savings for them, or they can get more modules quicker and more frequently, I don't see people having a big outrage and sort of linking arms to push back against this. Now, D&D did see a pretty coordinated pushback from an audience very recently when they tried to change the rules for third-party tools for D20, and they pretty swiftly had to reverse course and stop their idea to start kind of monetizing certain aspects of, you know, using their rules for your campaigns. They got a huge, big public outcry, and people pretty much in unison were dumping their sort of platform, if you will. That happened because, again, speaking on material reality, people were going to take a big hit to their pocketbook by these new rules being instituted. People that made a living off of utilizing the platform for D&D were going to just instantly overnight lose that revenue, lose that Patreon audience, lose the, you know, the scores and scores of content that they'd built up over the years. So you got to kind of look at where the money is going to be affected for these things. And I think that's a pretty good predictor of people's behavior. If AI is used in D&D, and that means a cost savings or more frequent drops, if you will, for them, I don't see a lot of customers having pushback about that. Might make their consumer experience better. If it's going to cost more, or it's going to affect them in the same way that rule change for D&D did, then I can expect a sort of more unified outcry.
Heading over to our Patreon,
which is located at patreon.com/JesseDestazio, we got two different questions about painting figures, so I'm going to read these together. Let's start with Lance Tomimoto. I want to fix an old Superpowers paint-rubbed figure, but I'm completely inexperienced in painting. Do you think that Gundam markers are sufficient? And from Shane, what's your process when hand-painting figures? I've tried a few new paints with mixed success, so I wanted to get your thoughts. So the good news is you don't have to rely on my own tips and tricks, because there's an entire universe of miniature painting content on YouTube that I follow myself and that has taught me quite a bit. So just check out anybody who's doing Wargaming miniatures, Warhammer. Those painting tips largely apply to what we do in the genre of action figure customization. So any of those stuff, any of the handy pointers that they're going to give you are probably going to apply to painting these figures like we're talking about here. To speak specifically to Lance's question about using Gundam markers, I would advise against that only because Gundam markers can rub off for sure, but you are not going to have as much control over the color and color matching, which is absolutely going to be crucial when it comes to covering up paint rubs. You want to be able to manipulate the shades and hue of a color when you're trying to sort of repair damage. So you're going to want to avoid Gundam markers for that specific scenario. The biggest thing I would impress upon people who want to customize their toys with paint is cleanliness. That is going to be the difference between your paint successfully adhering to the plastic and your paint not. So what you want to do is to clean surfaces with rubbing alcohol first and then let them dry. And I also recommend wearing gloves as you paint figures. The reason being, there is residual oil, dirt, whatever you want to call it, on figure surfaces. Even if they look clean, there will still be some residual barrier to the paint adhering on a molecular level. And secondly, there are oils and dirt and detritus on your hands. And as you touch the surface of a figure, if you're not wearing gloves, you're going to sort of cross-contaminate it in a way. The next thing you need to worry about is the thickness and consistency of your paint. You want almost a milk-like consistency. So typically, if you're using acrylic paints, you're going to need to water them down. You do not want the standard thickness of an acrylic paint applied to a plastic surface as is. It's going to leave streaks, it's going to clump, it's not going to look very good. What I do to save time is I actually use airbrush paints in acrylic, but I brush them on in a normal fashion. I do not use an airbrush gun. This is because airbrush paint is already sort of diluted. It has a great consistency that I find works perfect for touching up action figures. It's also important to realize you need to use multiple coats. A single go-through is not going to give you the coverage you want for your figure. You have to be very methodical and patient. You put on one layer, you let it dry, and you slowly build up on top of that layer. This is going to ensure a very smooth and professional looking paint job. There are previous Destaza pods where I've talked at greater length about painting, so I'll refer everybody to the enormous back catalog of 300 plus episodes if you want to get additional tips, but those are the basic ones that I think if you adhere to, you're going to do okay. I would also recommend have a junk figure with you that you can experiment on before you apply paint to the figure that is actually very valuable to you that you're trying to preserve. It's always good to have a junker that you can kind of experiment on first and get your flow and get your brush stroke right before you head over to the final one. Moving along, Gordon McKinnon Hall, what are your favorite design elements, themes, or music from Escaflowne? I'm going to be honest here. I'm sure I've probably seen an episode of Escaflowne. I have zero to no memory of ever watching Escaflowne. I think it was on Adult Swim for a brief period, but I did own Escaflowne figures because I love the mech designs. And it kind of takes place, as I gather, in a sort of quasi-medieval fantasy realm. And the idea of mechs that are giant suits of armor like a knight would wear is an incredibly appealing idea and motif to me. So I've always really gravitated towards them. I think also when it comes to mechs, like a lot of them can look the same, and it might be hard to point out what is something from a Gundam show versus, you know, something else. So I like the degrees of difference within the mech designs of Escaflowne that you don't find in most typical mech-based anime or manga. I would say also the sort of bad guy mechs are really cool design. They're sort of like a mix between, I don't know, a tank and a beetle. Very sort of delicate, subtle line work and silhouette work with these mechs. So I've always really loved them, even though I've never done a deep dive on the series itself. Danny Williford wants to know, will we ever see a Spice Fleet Army Builder pack? You know, the Spice Fleet figures did not sell well when they came out initially. I ended up having to split up the sets, and then eventually, I think, mark down and clearance out the remaining ones. While I was happy to do another nod to Spice Fleet with the final figure from AFOTM last year, I don't see a lot of potential for a Spice Fleet Army Builder in the future, just because it took me so long to sell through the original ones. Maybe we'll get an individual Spice Fleet captain or commander at some point, but I don't see there being a future for a multi-pack, which, you know, fewer people are going to buy than just a standard single release. Next question from Thomas Bucci. What old movies had rough CGI do you personally feel would benefit from having their CGI redone with modern technology and techniques? You know, for me, I don't have any. I'm perfectly fine for movies to exist as a time-stamped piece of art from the era they were created in. I think that that's actually the charm and what I like about older films. Now, granted, bad CGI can be very distracting, but, you know, Brian Eno, I'm paraphrasing him, but he said that whatever the technological limitations of a new type of technology are that people initially hate, those will become the things that people love as time moves on. So, you know, the sort of warmness of vinyl records, the, you know, the way a cassette tape sounds, early Hi-8 digital video, all of those limitations that were bothersome when this technology came out, they actually become very endearing, very unique qualities to these works of art. So I don't actually feel like any of these films need to be retouched or done over. If anything, films are going to get rebooted anyway. You know, Spawn is pointed out as one with terrible CGI. Spawn will eventually be rebooted. It's been in the works for several years. I think it's been derailed because of Jamie Foxx's health issues. But, you know, it seems like polishing the brass on the Titanic in some respects. So I'm happy for them to exist with their faults and all. Brett Barnicle, who has joined us on Helldivers 2, which we've all been playing quite a bit, he asks, am I enjoying the spread of democracy? Do I prefer dispensing liberty to the bugs or to the robots? I do recommend Helldiver 2. It's not redefining a genre, but it is a hell of a lot of fun to play with fellow Squires of the Slice. I absolutely prefer playing against the bugs. I went into my first robot battlefield yesterday and barely survived, just barely could keep up. I find the automaton onslaught to be really quite a jump and a spike in difficulty. So I prefer dispatching the bugs, if as it were. Next up, we got a hard question here from Chris Wynn. What are your top three gachapon series? I would say that, you know, slots 1, 2, and 3 are absolutely taken by Capsule Adventure, which was not a very long-lived series of gacha, but easily the most incredible ones ever made. So for those who don't know, you can actually go and watch some Toy Pizza YouTube videos about this very line, which Nikki and I happened to come across on our trip to Japan. These were basically like mechs and little accessories that you built around the gacha ball itself. And inside of that would be a cockpit where a pilot sat. And they're just ingenious designs. And they all work really well together. They even have little tiny pilots. One of the pilots has a fox head for some reason. They're just beautifully done. And the fact that they play with the form of the gacha ball itself adds another sort of element to it that I really quite love. Other honorable mentions would be the Epoch Dare Ori line, which are just kind of like skeletons with holes in them. In some cases, the skeletons ride a bigger mech skull. Like, it's very creative stuff, and I like them quite a bit. Although, you know, they do fall apart a little bit, and they're not the best constructed toys in the world. They are quite fun. For a final pick, there are these little stationary cars that I do not know the name of the line, but they are like from the Mad Max world, so they're kind of like smashed oil rigs and, you know, all these really sort of interesting wasteland style little cars. I quite like those quite a bit as well. Next question is from Brendan, and he wants to know about my decision to stop drinking alcohol. Is there a story to it, or any overall feelings about being pretty much alcohol free? You know, I definitely was a heavy drinker in my 20s and early 30s. I enjoyed drinking. I lived above a restaurant and bar, so I would go down almost every night and have a vodka soda and, you know, chat with my friends who were bartenders or waiters or waitresses there. You know, it was just part of my ritual. I started drinking, I don't know, relatively young, probably around 15, 16. And I just, you know, I liked to party. And it just started to not be worth it at a certain point. I think as you get into your 30s, you know, you start to experience real hangovers. You can kind of drink all night and get a couple hours sleep and then go into work in your 20s and just kind of power through. And I certainly did for most of my 20s. But once I got across the 30 threshold, I really started to get really bad hangovers where I would just be worthless for an entire day. And they only got more and more acute and profound the older I got. And even with drinking less, it didn't seem to matter. I would just have this full body reaction where I would just be ill, you know, pretty soon after drinking. Then the immediacy of it started as I creeped closer to 40. I would just start feeling sick the second I took a drink. You know, I think that this is probably a pretty clear case of being allergic to alcohol, which I you know, I would venture to guess most people are, but kind of power through. At the end of the day, the act of drinking alcohol is just poisoning yourself just a little bit, right? That is what physiologically is happening in the body. I think the other things that converged along this path were, one, just general overall health. There was a time when I was overweight and I was on a lot of antidepressants, and I just felt like shit all the time. I've always had a weak stomach, so drinking alcohol absolutely exacerbates every symptom of that. So there was a real sort of quality of life concern to tampering down drinking for me. The other thing that happened that was probably the most important factor in all of this is I started to hone a craft. I started to have mastery over what I was doing. It kind of converged with, you know, having Frederator as a client, meeting Nikki, having Toy Pizza as a big focus in my life, having the Night of the Slice toy line, and my sort of art and storytelling practice catching an audience and, you know, kind of just demanding more of my time and my attention. If you are able to lose yourself in an art form, you really don't want anything to distract you from that. That in some ways is a human being functioning at their highest level. And so if I have a comic that I am fired up to write and I can't wait to get it out to my readership, and I'm excited to do all this artwork and all this thumbnailing and all this writing, waking up and being hungover derails that creative process. And having a drink and trying to do the creative process can derail the creative process for me. So I started to, at a certain point, have to choose between creative pursuit and getting intoxicated. They could not coexist for me. I know they coexist for many people, and I know many people would swear by being able to create in better ways if they're under the influence of something. But for me, it doesn't work. I have to be sober to sort of really give my full attention and my full spirit to something that I want to create, whether it's a song or, you know, an illustration or a toy design, whatever the case may be. It works best for me if I'm not drunk or I'm not sort of trying to recover from a hangover. I have to sort of be still and be healthy to really fully actualize myself in these pursuits. So at a certain point, it did come down to a very simple calculus. Do I want to be doing my creative stuff or do I want to have a drink? And I couldn't really do both because the hangovers would just leave me laid out completely. It's also worth noting, I don't abstain 100% from consuming alcohol. If it's someone's birthday, if we're having a champagne toast, if it's New Year's, I'm not a teetotaler by any respect, but it's just not worth it for me to sort of spend the night drinking because I know almost immediately I'm going to feel sick, and then the next day I'm going to be worthless. So that's kind of the calculus that happens in my brain when I think about these things. What I can say also is that I've known a lot of people that have gone through similar changes. I know a lot of people that have gone through recovery and made it out on the other side. And I think universally, people that get on the other side of being afflicted by substances generally tend to love and dedicate themselves more to creative projects and creative pursuits. They tend to dispel for themselves this idea that you have to be wasted to make great art, and they find a much healthier balance to what they're doing. I don't know if that applies to everybody, and I'm not here to sort of have a moralistic stance on any of this, but I do think it's interesting that the highly creative people I know that maybe were at the same position as me in their 20s that have sort of gotten on the other side of that, they've become even more prolific and had more time and more space and more bandwidth to dedicate to creative projects. And I think that's sort of worthy and of note. In a rare outing, I posted on our Knights of the Slice Facebook group and solicited a couple questions. So let's go through those. Ian Amling, why do you think some independent action figures are failing to attract sales and interest, especially when it seems like others, on Kickstarter to be specific, are excelling in the market? Well, I suppose if I knew the answer to that question, I would have a license to print money, right? I think largely the things that are doing well on Kickstarter right now are fantasy-based, and they are 6-inch in scale-based. But I would also caution, 6 to 7-inch in scale, I would also caution that Kickstarter campaigns are not always what they seem. And if you are a curious and enterprising individual, there's something you can do to determine how much inflation is going on with a Kickstarter campaign. So first thing you can do is download a web browser extension called KickTrack. These are very helpful device as application, if you will. It will give you very, very nuanced information about a Kickstarter on a separate page. Now, this is not proprietary information. They are just gleaning publicly available information and knowledge, and they have their own sort of algorithms that help predict how campaigns may go. I find it very useful. I use KickTrack a lot when I'm doing a Kickstarter campaign. But the important thing to look at is big peaks in donations in the middle of a campaign. And then if you cross-reference days when they're getting thousands and thousands of dollars versus the amount of new backers, this is the key to determining how much boosting is happening in a campaign. If there's a campaign that raises $10,000 in a single day, but they only got two new campaign members, backers that day, you can safely assume that they have made an arrangement with a friend or a third party to invest an ample sum of cash within their campaign and get their goal higher up. The suspicious patterns for this are, again, middle of the campaign and on days when there's only been one or two or a handful of new backers. You can also sort of, you know, figure out what a per day backer average is. And then if it exceeds that by several orders of magnitude, you can kind of deduce that something fishy may be going on. I've certainly seen this happen. Now, look, granted, there are milestones and events that happen where a very generous backer will put in a large lump sum. You know, I have offered very high tier, top level backing campaigns. Usually you get to design a figure or something along those lines. And that would skew the data on KickTrack as well, except that there is a tier that corresponds to a high ticket item. I'm not even going to say that. That may be inflammatory. However, again, if you're enterprising, you can go into these campaigns and you can see pretty clearly there is a pattern of these very generous backers that happen to influence these campaigns in a positive fashion. I think also stylistically, if you follow the 6-inch, 7-inch scale figure line and you try to mimic the success of Mythic Legions, you're probably going to fund because that is where the biggest share of the customer base is, right? I think Mythic Legions, the Four Horsemen, have built up what is the sort of modern 6-inch independent crowdfunding fan base. And so really these campaigns are a question of how much percentage can you tap into that already existing fan base. And if you're going to use fantasy as your genre and your motif, I see the crossover as being that much easier to sort of attract some of those people. Oh, this new figure line, it has medieval reptile figures, and I have my Mythic Legions, and these would look really good on the shelf together, so I'm more likely to back this campaign. So I think, you know, those fundamentals are probably, you know, somewhat at play for these campaigns, but that puts somebody like me at a disadvantage for traditional success, because I'm not really interested in doing any of that stuff. I'm not interested in the 6-inch scale, and I'm not interested in, you know, repeating what everybody else is doing. Next up from Sam Sherry, I noticed the new Bruiserbot head resembles one of the unmade Sen heads. Is there a possibility we might see those other unmade heads? So very good eye. On the Patreon, I think I went through the process of salvaging this original prototype head from the very first Sen figure, which looks a lot different from the Sen figure that we have. It's an entirely new sculpt, in fact. But yes, this is from that first handmade sample, and it was sculpted by Ant Suck, and I'm very happy to finally add this into the pantheon of different Knight of the Slice figure pieces. Regarding seeing other unmade heads from the Sen figure, I don't think that's very likely because they've been improved upon in the original release of the figure. There's definitely an absolute opportunity for other unmade heads from other figures, both seen and unseen by the public, to come into the Knight of the Slice line. I think, you know, I'm never going to stop doing that, and I have hundreds and hundreds of sculpted heads that I would like to fit into different molds at a certain point. Now, with all that out of the way, I think we can call this episode done. We're going to stick a fork in it. There's a new video out that will help you plan your travel to Beacon, New York for Toy Pizza Expo on June 16th. We look forward to seeing you there. Go check YouTube. You can watch this pretty informative and great video. If you haven't already, please get your tickets for the Chapo WFYM live show. I believe we have sold quite a bit of these tickets, and the first show is likely to sell out. If we had a second show, these shows are going to be different, so you can get both shows should they happen, and you will be thoroughly entertained in a secondary different way. So that's exciting. That's everything I got for you. To play us out today is ZStar 7. Pizza out.
I'm going to go to the next one.